Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Washington reached out to Muslims. John Adams called the Prophet Muhammad one of history's great truth seekers. Thomas Jefferson hosted an iftar dinner in the White House. George W. Bush repeatedly spoke of treasuring American Muslims and against bigotry. But in the last few months, weeks, days, it's gotten a lot tougher out there. Where is this going and why? This hour on Point, top Muslim scholar Akbar Ahmad on this country's Muslims and the new American identity challenge. And we'll hear from Reza Aslan about how it feels to be Muslim American in this storm. You can join the conversation. What's gone on here these past few months, days? How do we get past this? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, a Pakistani Muslim who has advised General David Petraeus, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, and more. He holds chairs in Islamic studies at American University in Washington and at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. He led a team of researchers across the country visiting 100 mosques in 75 American cities and towns. Their findings have just come out in a documentary and book of the same title, Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. Ambassador Ahmad, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much, Tom. Great program you have, and I'm honored to be on it.
You're being called a new kind of a Tocqueville for our time of strain around this issue. What did you find out there, sir?
First of all, Tom, let me modestly reject that title. Tocqueville is one of my great heroes, and he really gave us a unique insight into American society in the 19th century. What we found was, my team and myself, was that we are living in times of rapid change, of crisis, that everyone, white and non-white, Muslim and non-Muslim, were feeling under siege, under pressure. There was the economy, there was the immigration issues, there was the first non-white president in the White House. There were the wars overseas, the unending war in Afghanistan. All this was adding to a sense of fear, uncertainty. And inside all this arena, if you like, of American society, you had the lightning rod of Islam. And we felt in the field that all you needed was a catalyst to set it off. And you saw that with the mosque issue in New York and the pastor in Florida.
You actually visited these mosques well before things really blew up again in the past few months. It was a year and more ago. But 100 mosques is a lot. It's enough to get a very sort of deep dish sense of American Muslims. At that time, did they fear that things could go, you know, in the kind of bad way that we've seen in the last few months here?
Exactly, Tom. In fact, we finished our project last year, and in the field, we had a very good sense of what was happening, which surprised me somewhat sitting in Washington. I knew there were some problems. I knew that the gap that had opened up between Muslims and non-Muslims after 9/11 had not really closed, and all the polls were confirming it. But what I did not realize was the sense of unease in the Muslim community. While many Muslims told us this is the best place in the world to be Muslim, many quoted Thomas Jefferson as their icons and so on, we saw evidence, for example, in Columbia, Tennessee, we saw a mosque firebombed, other mosques with windows smashed or graffiti on the walls. So there was that sense of unease. Muslims themselves were not confident about telling us these things openly, but we could see we were anthropologists looking at society. And as anthropologists, we were taking notes, we were doing interviews, we interviewed thousands of people, and we were able to put two and two together. Remember, the anthropologist, Tom, holds a mirror up to society. So there's some things which are very inspiring and some things which are challenging.
All right, you're the anthropologist then, and you've been in 100 mosques around the United States. Do you see a fundamental structural problem here, or just a kind of bump in the road, another moment, you know, of indigestion in the melting pot? Which?
Tom, that is the key question I'm trying to answer in the book. We do have a problem, and the problem really is the Muslim community leadership. We have a problem in mosques where there is a problem with the boards running the mosques. The imams, sometimes who come in from the Middle East and South Asia, don't know the culture here. So there's a problem between them and the young generation. The young generation are having all kinds of cultural issues, the issues of dating, drinking, drugs, and so on, like normal teenagers. who do they go to? If they can't get satisfactory answers from their parents or from the imam, sometimes they go online and they are then connected with the world outside. You then have the problem of the homegrown terrorists who are coming out of this particular generation. And even two or four or five of these young men can, as you know, create a crisis which will spiral out of control, considering how tense the situation is. So we saw a community divided. There's the ethnic divisions. You have the African-American Muslims. You have the Asian Muslims. South Asian Muslims, you have the Middle East Arab Muslims. Now, within this division, you have national, sectarian divisions, further divisions, and you do not then have a picture of a unified Muslim leadership, a leadership which knows where it's going, which has some sense of a vision, some sense of a strategy, an objective. And therefore, I feel that unless Muslim leadership itself very quickly comes to grips with the situation, you may have a problem which will then have a triggering effect on mainstream American society.
Well, you've looked at Muslims around the world in an earlier book, Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization. But Americans have been watching what's going on in Europe, kind of a real cultural deadlock there in the last decade. And there's been a lot of self-congratulation in this country saying, you know, thank heavens, that's not the way we've gone. We've been much more effective in integrating and accepting Muslims here. Is the United States at risk of going down that sort of European road of getting into such a cultural deadlock? Or, you know, can we ultimately get over this and absorb this community as we have absorbed so many?
Ultimately, I would say yes to your question, Tom, and this is the big question, because while I'm looking at this as a crisis around the Muslim community and a debate around them, in fact, this is a debate about America. This is a debate about American identity. This is the conclusion of my book, and my book is literally right out of the field trip. Mm-hmm. It is just coming straight out of it. There is an intense debate. What kind of America do Americans want? Is it what you just pointed out in your quotations from the Founding Fathers, a genuinely pluralist society that respects all regardless of their color or their race or their religion or their background? Or is it going to be a society where you'll have tensions around communities, in this case, the Muslim community? Now, there's a difference in terms of the background and history of the Muslim community here and in Europe. And I've spent many years in England watching and interacting with the community there. Remember that the Muslims in Europe, South Asians who came to England, North Africans who came to France and Spain and so on, have that colonial link. So they came with cultural baggage. Mm-hmm. In America, they came, not the African Americans who were brought here as slaves and eventually lost their Islam and rediscovered it. But the immigrants coming after the Second World War came voluntarily. They were coming to participate in the American dream. They were coming to be part of this wonderful, free, democratic society. So there's a fundamental difference in how Muslims came here, how they were adjusted, and how they lived until 9/11. And 9/11 really changed everything. And that gap I spoke of, which opened, unfortunately, was never filled, Tom. And the problem there, again, goes partly back to the Muslims who were not able to explain what Islam was, their culture, their traditions to Americans. And in that vacuum, you had a lot of commentators, and I say this with great regret, who played the role of creating a hysteria around Muslims so that you had a vacuum already about Muslims. And into that vacuum, you had people talking about the terrorist next door and the terrorist who's lurking under the so-called moderate and so on, so that Americans were genuinely confused, alarmed, mystified, and have very little trust anymore in Muslims. Those are the polls, 50, 60, 70%. And we found that in the field. Americans wanted to understand Islam. They are very open people. They're curious people, mainstream Americans. And they had very little understanding of Islam. This is the huge challenge we face.
You look at Americans, all Americans, not just Muslim Americans. You talked about the pluralistic tradition in this country, but you say there are other very strong traditions, one you call primordial and another you call predatory. What does that mean?
Tom, mine is an anthropological study. So again, I, as an anthropologist, had to become a scholar of American history, which I'm not, American society, which I'm not. And it was a great pleasure really coming to grips with these wonderful subjects. And I had this very enthusiastic team of mine who would spend hours and hours in the field talking to people and in the libraries. And so we constructed three distinct identities going straight back to Plymouth, to Plymouth Rock and the arrival of the Mayflower, 1620. There you see the first signs of these three distinct identities, which would then grow as a major stream within American society. And these three identities, primordial, predator, and pluralist, are constantly overlapping, constantly in play, and sometimes predator and pluralist are directly in confrontation. So you have the classic confrontation of someone who believes in the vision of the founding fathers would be pluralist. That's unambiguous. The founding fathers are probably the most extraordinary set of founding fathers anywhere in any country in the world. And that is what makes America, America.
But predator, what's that mean?
Predator means, for example, go back to 1620. You had a lot of settlers who said, this land is white. It is Anglo, specifically racially, and it is Christian. And anyone who is not part of this these features, who doesn't have these features, is to be exterminated, literally. So you had Winslow, who is the first governor, his son Josiah Winslow, who becomes governor also, who simply goes out to exterminate the Indians, the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And the Native Americans, Tom, I mean, in your part of the world, up in Boston and around there, you can check this up. Within a few decades, something like 80% are finished. I mean, they're just wiped out. Either they're sent as slaves to the West Indies, or they're killed, or they're chased off their lands. So that is the predatory instinct in those settlers, where they feel that any threat on the community must be met by complete force and what was then called zero tolerance. And you see some of this even today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American Muslims under the onslaught of fiery headlines and a new American identity challenge, maybe, underway. Ambassador Akbar Ahmed is with us, a Pakistani who is now chairs the Department in Islamic Studies at American University and at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. He and a team of recently gone across this country visiting 100 mosques in 75 cities and towns. Their new book and documentary is Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. But this stuff is very real and very right now. Ambassador Ahmed, please stand by in Washington, if you would. Joining us right now as well from Los Angeles, California, is Reza Aslan, contributing editor to The Daily Beast, author of Beyond Fundamentalism and No God But God. He's been talking and thinking a lot about what he and other Muslim Americans are seeing in recent weeks. Reza Aslan, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me back.
So here I am reading today in the Washington Post. I'll put this to you and to the ambassador. This is Tariq Ramadan, very prominent, no-shrinking violet Muslim. And he says, whatever the tainted atmosphere today, the United States is not inherently anti-Islam in a religious sense or anti-Muslim in a racial sense. He says it's time for Muslims not to be on the defensive, to stop apologizing for being Muslims, be more assertive about their values, duties. This is not a time, he says, for intellectual, social, political, economic, or cultural isolation. What do you say to that view, Reza?
Well, I think he's right. The United States is not anti-Islam. That's certain. And I think Ambassador Ahmed has made it very clear that, historically speaking, the United States has been quite tolerant of Islam as a religion, and Islam has often been, you know, very much a part of the religious fabric of this country. However, the United States is becoming increasingly anti-Muslim, by which I mean that anti-Muslim sentiment and negative views about Islam are at unprecedented levels in the United States. And there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, certainly the economy has something to do with it. In times of economic distress, it's only natural for Americans to have the most xenophobic parts of their nature come out. And it seems this year the primary target of that xenophobia has not only been Muslims, but has frankly also been Mexicans. I live in California, and I'm hear a lot of the same kind of rhetoric about undocumented aliens that I hear about Muslim Americans. And some of it has to do with President Obama. Let's be clear here. A fifth of Americans believe that the president is a Muslim. And in fact, amongst Republicans, that number is in about 30-35%. So I think, in a sense, Islam, or rather Muslims, have become the new other, the sort of internal enemy that one can point at when times are rough, to kind of pour one's fears the sense of threat upon them.
Riza, you sound very poised about it, but we heard your commentary on NPR. You said, you know, sometimes it's the onslaught feels so much, as a Muslim American, you can barely control your anger.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the vileness that some of the bigotry against Muslims has become, you know, just so mainstream. I think that's the thing that's so surprising to a lot of people. Look, there have always been people in the United States, mostly on the margins and the fringes, who believe that Islam is, quote, of the devil, and that, you know, Muslims are not truly Americans. But for the most part, they stayed on the fringes. What is, I think, shocking for a lot of Muslims is that the kind of rhetoric that used to be reserved for the margins is now becoming very much mainstream, with politicians now on both sides of the aisle openly and explicitly espousing anti-Muslim sentiment, associating American Muslims with Al-Qaeda. That kind of rhetoric, I think, would have been unimaginable even a year ago. That's, I think, what's truly changed.
Akbar Ahmed, what do you see going on here? Tariq Ramadan says America's not anti-Islam, anti-Muslim, but he says a natural and understandable concerns can be transformed into active rejection and open racism when political discourse and media coverage fan the flames for ideological, religious, or economic interests. Do you see that happening here, Ambassador?
Tom, I think we all have to step back and look at American history. In the 19th century, early 20th century, you had other immigrant groups, the Catholic Irish coming here, the Jews coming here, and all of them having a very rough time integrating. Remember, it took them decades and decades, facing real hardship, real violence, and eventually, after the Second World War, they were absorbed. Now, the Muslims, strangely enough, and here's something very interesting, keep the African-Americans aside, that's a separate story. The immigrants had an easy time of it. They came really in the 70s, 80s. They flew in from the Middle East, from South Asia, straight in as doctors, as professors, and so on. And they were off the radar screen. It was only after 9/11 when Americans woke up and said, this guy, this doctor of mine, he's Chaudhry or Khan or Qureshi, he's a Muslim. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? And suddenly all the questions that should have been answered decades ago were out there, and they were not being answered. So therefore, when we traveled throughout the United States, and remember, Tom, we traveled for 1 year. This is a long fieldwork trip.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When we traveled and we went to every kind of home, Jew, Christian, Muslim, everywhere, we met every kind of Muslim.
I see you're posing here, some of your people before a sign welcoming you to Arab, Alabama. A-R-A-B,
yes.
Good heavens.
And one of my assistants, Jonathan, is from that part of the world. So he said this is a little town
America.
Hostile to. And we went there and we had a very nice reception and people were very friendly. So the point I'm making is this, that very often in places like Arab and small towns, Americans would ask us, they would say, we've never met a Muslim before. Why do people want the Sharia? Or why do you treat women so badly? Or where are the moderates? And when we would explain to them calmly and coolly, they would change their perception. There really is a gap, a chasm of knowledge and understanding, because I go back, Tom, you had quoted the founding fathers. You quoted them on Islam. Just think of it. We are talking the late 18th century when the world had dictators and tyrants and despots all over the world. And here you have this extraordinary vision of these extraordinary men wanting a new kind of society. You omitted Benjamin Franklin. He called the Prophet of Islam a model of compassion. Now put that in the context of what Americans are saying today in the early 21st century about Islam, about the Prophet. And Tom, I can say, because Raza is one of the very few voices out there in the media, that some of the virulence that you read in the media, it really, you know, like Raza, every Muslim gets taken aback. I wrote an article on CNN.com recently about Pastor Terry Jones before it became a real big issue. And we had something like 6,000 comments. And Tom, listen to this. 80% of those comments were something like this. Not only should we burn the Quran, throw a few Muslims into the fire or bring marshmallows along for this. So, you know, there was that sense of here's this community. It's suddenly despised. It's hated. There's so much ignorance around it. And let's just take it on. And I had pointed out in that article, this is weeks ago, that this is going to have a very negative impact on General Petraeus and his troops, because they are out there to win hearts and minds, and it's not going to help them if their local Afghans and Pakistanis saw Americans here in mainland America burning the Quran, their holy book.
It's hard to see it not making trouble for General Petraeus. But Reza, I mean, Akbar Ahmed talks about when Catholics came and the difficulties in integrating Jews and others. But this is a globalized time. Everybody saw what happened on 9/11. And there is a global Islamic fundamentalist movement here that I don't think had a counterpart when Catholics came, when Jews came to this country. There's a different global picture this time.
Well, that's true. The global picture is indeed different. But what's not different is the argument. The argument against the Catholics in the 19th century with politicians like the Know-Nothings was that Catholics, by definition, cannot be Americans, that by definition, their loyalty cannot rest with the United States, that their loyalty is elsewhere, that their loyalty lies in Rome. And the same argument was made about Jews with people like Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh and politicians like Louis McFadden talking about a global Jewish conspiracy to force the United States into the Second World War. And that argument that, by definition, Muslims can't be Americans, that their loyalties cannot possibly lie with this country, is an argument that we've heard a lot by a lot, you know, made against a number of other religious and ethnic communities. And I think, you know, one thing that Akbar says, which I think is really important, that allows us to put a little bit of perspective, if you will, on this entire anti-Muslim controversy, is that we look back on those other periods with shame and with derision and with a little bit of humor. You know, we make fun of those people. And I think that the same thing's going to happen again here. When we look back at this time, maybe 10, 20, 30 years from now, we will look back at it with some shame, with some derision, but we'll also laugh at ourselves and we'll think, you know, how silly were we that we thought that this 6 to 8 million Muslims in this country who are thoroughly integrated into every level of American society, who have, as an immigrant community, higher than average incomes, higher than average levels of literacy and education, the notion that, you know, somehow they couldn't be one of us, it seems so absurd now that it's hard to believe that people were making it. And I think that's the true story here, the religious fabric of America, the commitment to liberty and pluralism that makes this country what it is, that's unshakable. No matter what happens here and there every once in a while, that part of our country's identity, I think, is unshakable.
We may look back and laugh, shake our heads. I hope you're right. It's a hopeful view. Lynn in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just think it's so shameful and hypocritical the way that certain political segments of our society now are just giving out, you know, false information and, you know, just fomenting bigotry, and I just find it so shameful. And so I never thought I would see this, you know, in our time. And it's, I don't know, I just can't get past how shameful it is.
There's a sharp sentiment from Buffalo, and let us hold that, Lynn. One more, Montreal in Canada. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Very interesting issues here. I just want to make some observations. I was spending a lot of time in Turkey recently, and I went through Austria, Vienna. And there's a big problem in Europe, which is similar to what America is experiencing, where there's a parallel society being created. And by that, I mean in Austria, you have about 8 million people with 500,000 Muslims. So if you put it into perspective, I'm not a great mathematician, but that's a sizable amount.
Yep.
It's a sizable minority.
A higher ratio, what we have here, 300 million in the United States and maybe 7 million Muslims, something like that.
it's quite an amount, and most of them are from Turkey. They were Gastarbeiters or guest workers who came and settled, and they had a new generation of children and so forth. But what's happening now is that, like in America, things have come to the boiling point, where the government is trying to accommodate to Islam and its traditions, and yet it doesn't seem to be doing enough as far as the Muslim community is concerned. And I'll be very quick and specific. The leader of the Muslim community in Austria said that there should be mosques built in every major town and city in Austria. And this really was the equivalent of the 9/11 mosque issue in New York. It sparked so much outrage and so much media coverage.
But did he say that as an integrated part of Austria, or as you describe, a parallel society, Bob?
Well, thank you for I'll try to make the nuance. The problem is that some people think that the Turkish or Muslim minority wants to, live as if they were in a Muslim country and not make any effort to learn the local language, which is German.
Bob, let us take it right there. That's interesting to bring to you, Akbar Ahmed. There comes the echo from Europe and Austria feeling, oh my gosh. I think we've got churches and we've got synagogues and we've got Mormon tabernacles all over this country and integrated peoples. Is Islam different? What if there were a mosque in every city and town? Would we have a parallel society develop, or, the American integration story?
Tom, I would request Bob to be a bit cautious. I've spent a lot of time in Europe. I've written about the Muslims there. I've interacted with them. Take England as a good example. You have groups, there's no doubt about it, who live isolated culturally in cocoons like in Bradford, Birmingham and so on. They even speak the ethnic language. They'd speak, for example, Punjabi and so on. On the other hand, you have this remarkable, remarkable development in Britain where something like 12 members of the House of Lords and House of Commons are Muslim. The cricket captain of the team, the English cricket team, which is a very prestigious game in England, was a Muslim. Some of the BBC presenters, very well-known faces, are Muslim. So there's also this parallel development where Muslims are the part of the fabric of English society, no one challenges it.
Right, but I'm looking here at your own journey through this country, Stone Mountain, Georgia, and you're in a Salafi mosque there, kind of hidden and unmarked in a nondescript strip mall, And you report their website declaring Jews and Christians are waging a war upon Islam and that Muslims who, quote, believe in, quote, democracy are on a, quote, criminal path. That doesn't sound like integrating.
No, not at all. And you're right to point that out because I myself, as you know, in the opening of the book, sailed into a full-fledged ambush, as it were, and was attacked precisely by people like this.
In Omaha, Nebraska.
Yeah, that's right. And for suggesting that Jews and Christians, according to Islamic belief, are part of the brotherhood, the people of the book, and we must have the most cordial relations and reach out to them. I divide it like this, Tom, and it's important for the listeners to hold on to this idea. Muslims are not a monolith, least of all in America, where the entire Muslim world is represented, as we found Cambodian Muslims, Thai Muslims, Japanese Muslims, the whole world. I would divide them into three broad categories: the mystics, those who believe in universal humanism, the modernists who believe we can be American and also Muslim and be proud of both traditions, balancing religion with modernity, and then the literalists who believe we must behave like and do everything that was done in the 7th century around the Prophet of Islam and his companions. Now, not all literalists are violent by any means or advocate violence, but some of them may feel Islam is under attack, we have to defend Islam, and we defend it by being this defensive, exactly as you quoted, that Jews and Christians are the enemy and they're out to get us. And any modernist, any moderate Muslim, which would include someone like Reza or myself, is also allied with the enemy rather than with us. And in that sense, we then become the targets within the community. It is this dynamic, this interplay of three distinct Muslims that you will see throughout the mosques of the United States, which is often overlooked because Americans see all mosques as a monolith and Muslims as a monolith.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American Muslims under the onslaught of fiery headlines and a new American identity challenge. Reza Aslan joins us from Los Angeles. He is author of Beyond Fundamentalism, Confronting Religious Extremism in the Age of Globalization. And from Washington, we're joined by Ambassador Akbar Ahmed. He was Pakistan's ambassador to the United Kingdom, has written about Islam around the world, went out with a team across this country to 100 mosques in 75 cities and towns, has come out with the book Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. Let's go to our listeners. Jim, in Iowa City, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air.
Greetings. Two points, one big one, small. I am just south by about 50 miles from Cedar Rapids, where the very first mosque in America was built. At least that's the story that gets passed around there. I'm wondering if they got a chance to go and talk to the people in Cedar Rapids, and I'm wondering if they found any difference in the attitudes between the people in that centralized part of America and, say, either coast. And the second point is related to some commentator earlier about the Catholics in America. That's not recent history. Mm-hmm. I grew up in small town Iowa. We had crosses burned on my priest's lawn, and some of the things that my dad's patients would do because he was Catholic. Just anyway.
We're a pluralistic country, but we haven't made it easy for people joining that pluralism very often. Jim, I appreciate your call. Akbar Ahmed, what about the early mosque there in Iowa? And did you find a difference between the center of the country and the coasts?
Tom, you're right, and Jim is right. We did go to Cedar Rapids. We went to the oldest mosque in America. It's called the Mother Mosque, built in 1934. And, you know, we met some remarkable people there. We met people who had been in the United States from Lebanon and the Middle East for four generations. We couldn't tell them apart from any local person. They wore jeans. They had this glorious tan on their faces. They even joined. They said every year we go off on this these motorbike gangs across the country, the Hell's Angels kind of gangs, and they invited my team, the younger members, to join them. Of course, I firmly declined. I said, let them finish their field work first. But so you do have that sense of local hospitality, receiving these foreigners, strangers coming from the Middle East, and they're becoming part of the landscape. It's again after 9/11 when everything is up in the air. What we did find was, Tom, and this is interesting, the local mosque, the big mosque, did tell us, these old residents did tell us that recently in the last decade or two, some of the imams had come with messages from the Middle East which were much, much more literalist than they were used to. And that internal tension was being played out in the mosque there, so that you could immediately see that tension building up between some Muslims advocating a much more hardline kind of Islam through the imam, and the board that runs the mosque, and those who, like the people we met, had been living there for generations and wanted to have a much more relaxed, more pluralist identity in terms of this American identity we are talking about. So it really, again, the need to step back and take a much more nuanced, sophisticated look at what's going on. Look at the Muslim community, but look at American identity also, without which, Tom, it's going to be an incomplete picture, and that is what's happening in the media, where we're all hysterical one day about the pastor in Florida, next day about the imam in New York, and we're not getting to grips with what is really happening in America today.
Joe in Needham, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. My question for your guest, and I've been wondering this for 9 years now, is why hasn't there been a huge outcry from the moderate American Muslims and Muslims throughout the world against these Islamic extremists within their communities?
Reza, let me come first to you on that. That is something we hear again and again. Is it a reasonable complaint, and what's going on?
Well, look, you know, for 10 years I've been hearing that question, and I just don't know where the question comes from, because the fact of the matter is that the voice of American Muslims has been almost incessantly screaming as loud as it possibly can, condemning all acts of violence. There have been tens of thousands of fatwas and statements by dozens of American Muslim organizations on a weekly, sometimes daily basis. Now, why is it that people don't hear it? Well, I mean, I suppose you could blame the media for that. I mean, in some ways, by definition, the voice of the moderate is not going to be as loud or as sexy as the voice of extremism. I could write 100 books. I could be on 100 different interviews, and all it takes is just one guy with one plane ramming it into one building, and that's the end of the conversation. But I guess the truth is that, you know, this same kind of idea that, well, somehow, you know, Muslims aren't really condemning violence or terrorism, which is about as false a statement as you could possibly imagine, just fits into the overall narrative that, well, it, you know, Islam somehow is different, or that, you know, there really isn't such a thing as a Muslim moderate, if you will. That kind of sort of false information that just keeps going around and around and around, and you yourself said, Tom, you hear this all the time. You know, I think it just sort of fits into that overall narrative of Islam as being other and foreign.
Tom, could I also make a comment here?
Yes.
Tom, on 9/11, I was in Washington at the DCC, that's the Jewish Community Center, in Theater J, which is a major theater in Washington, D.C. And we were part of a huge group, interfaith group, Jews, Christians, Muslims. And I was asked to give the keynote. Now, just think of it. 9/11, the main event in Washington, D.C., a Muslim is giving the keynote in a Jewish community center with Theater J, one of the most prestigious theaters in Washington, D.C. And the media entirely ignored us. The focus was entirely on the mosque. Create it, don't create it, build it here, build it there. The fact of the matter, Joe, and I'm addressing you directly, is there are thousands and thousands and thousands of what you call the moderates who are out there, who are fighting, and they're in the front line, Joe, my friend. It is Benazir Bhutto, a prime minister, former prime minister of Pakistan, who goes back to Pakistan and is blown up. She's killed fighting for what you're calling moderate Islam. So when you say you don't hear them, Joe, I would request you to tune up your hearing aid a little bit sharper, because they're out there. You're not listening to them. 30,000 Pakistanis have died fighting the extremists and the Taliban in Pakistan. My wife's six of her cousins, Tom, first cousins, died fighting the Taliban in Swat. She comes from Swat. She's part of the royal family there. For us Muslims, this is a real battle. It's taking place, and we are there in the thick of the fray. What? So to dismiss us, Tom, really is not only an insult, but really not understanding what's going on in the Muslim world. And that's why in my first trip, I went to the Muslim world, to the Middle East, South Asia, Far East Asia, and we interviewed thousands of Muslims. And again, we've got this very rich data, very rich ethnography to tell us what's going on in the Muslim world.
But you've got a battle going on. You write a lot about it globally within Islam. And you describe how, you know, messages from the, you call them literalists, you might say fundamentalists, come into this country, whether it's in Georgia or Cedar Rapids, you know, with that message that is against democracy, that is not so tolerant. I mean, what if the moderates don't win this battle, but yet we're part of one world now?
Tom, again, put it in context. In the 50s and 60s, straight after the Second World War, when Muslim countries began to get their independence, take a look at the world, what's happening there. Morocco, Pakistan, all the countries then were led by men who were modernists. They wanted to be part of the modern order. They wanted a new world for the Muslims, rights for them, justice for them, law and order for them. Now, that modernist vision begins to falter and fail in the 80s and 90s. And you have the Islamic Revolution of Iran. You have then the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And the response to that, fueled by the American intelligence agencies and Pakistan agencies, is, of course, to resurrect jihad as a weapon of war against the Soviets. In the 1990s, the Americans just walk away from that arena. And in that vacuum, step who? The Taliban. And in the 1990s, you have the emergence of the Taliban. So the world is changing. And for the ordinary Muslim, seeing these three models, the mystics, they don't want anything to do with the world, so they're in their own world, as it were. Mm-hmm. The modernists who failed, the only viable alternative was the literalist. So this battle is not over. We are in the middle of it. And there is no way that you can just dismiss the modernists and say they failed. Because when it comes to elections, Tom, this is the good news. Take Pakistan again. When it came to the elections, recently, the most recent elections, who won the elections? It was the Pakistan People's Party or the Muslim League, both modernist parties. The religious parties, the Jamaat-e-Islami and so on, got very, very few seats in parliament. A parliament, maybe 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 seats. So again, we need to understand what's going on and not just impose our own ignorance or prejudices on to the Muslim world.
Absolutely. But Reza, I mean, back in the time when Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were, you know, having the Quran and the talking very idealistically, any intra-Islam conflicts were quite far away. Now they feel like they're in our laps.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I just want to just kind of close up the last discussion real quick, because there's something else about the question of where are the moderates. There's an assumption embedded into it that I think is a little bit disturbing, and that is that the 1.5 billion people around the world for whom Islam forms an identity and faith, that the majority of them are radicals and extremists, and that there's this tiny group of moderates who aren't getting their voices heard. Islam, Muslims, are the moderates. I mean, you have this very small but obviously very loud voice of violence and extremism that in the United States, in the Western world, is often confused as the voice of Islam. And this has partly to do with this sort of one, major problem that I like to say that Islam has, which is that there is no Muslim Pope in Islam. There is no Muslim Vatican. There is no centralized religious authority with the power to speak for all the world's Muslims. There's no force that can say what is and what is not proper Islamic behavior. By definition, anyone who claims to be a Muslim is a Muslim, which is why I reject sort of the easy sort of rhetoric that you get from a lot of modernist or westernized Muslims who will just simply say, well, the 9/11 hijackers, they weren't really Muslim. No, that's not true. They were Muslim. They called themselves Muslims, therefore they were. And because Islam, unlike Catholicism, the world's largest religious tradition, because Islam, the second largest religious tradition, doesn't have the ability to simply, excommunicate a Muslim, doesn't have the ability to say who is and who is not a Muslim, what you have is this sort of shouting match between dozens and dozens of different interpretations and views of Islam, and in any shouting match, as you well know, it's the loudest voice that gets heard. But let's not confuse the loudest voice for the majority voice.
Well, shouting at the very least. Nina in Winchester, Virginia. Nina, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a comment about Islam and the religion. I grew up in the Muslim country, and I am a Christian. I born Christian, but I live in a Muslim country.
Which country, Nina? Which country?
It is Iran.
Okay.
And I moved to United States about 26 years ago because of my religion. That's why I left my country. Islam is a religion of war. They just don't tolerate with anything. If you are a Christian, they won't let you to practice your religion in any kind of Muslim country. If you want to build a church right now in any kind of Muslim country, they won't let you do that.
But what about in this country? What does that mean for this country? We take your point, Nino. Take it. But what does it mean for the United States then? What should it tell us here?
I think they are taking advantage of American culture, American people, that they are very honest, and the Constitution of the United States, because freedom is one of the first things in our...
Nina, our time is so short. Akbar Ahmad, Nina kind of saying, look, don't sweet talk me. I've been there. It wasn't easy. And watch out here.
Nina is partly right, Tom, but it's not about Muslims alone. I keep pointing out it is about America. Are we going to compromise the vision of the Founding Fathers? It's as simple as that. Is America going to be America, or is it going to become something else because of its relationship with Islam? And as far as Nina's concerned, maybe her experience in Iran wasn't a good one, Tom. My experience, let me share it with your listeners. I grew up in North Pakistan, a small town, being educated by the Catholic priest at Burnhall, one of the top schools of Pakistan, and later educated at Foreman Christian College in Lahore, run by Presbyterian American teachers. We had the most cordial relations with the Christians there. They respected us. We respected them. Today, of course, Pakistan is going through a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of law and order problems, and there's no doubt that Christians are being persecuted, as are the Sufis, for example. They just almost blew up the greatest Sufi shrine in Lahore. So we are going through a period of turmoil. I would not say that there are no churches. That's just not true, because the biggest church in Abbottabad, where I grew up, was a church, biggest church in the center of town. And again, the biggest church in Karachi is exactly where it was when Pakistan was created. No one's touched it, and it's almost deserted. There are not many Christians left. But the fact of the matter is that we are going through a crisis in the Muslim world, and there is a debate and there is a very intense battle for this identity within Islam itself.
Reza, we've got security tensions globally, we've got economic tensions globally, and we've got a battle within Islam. And now, in these last few months, we've got real tension around Muslims in this country. Where do you see this going, Reza?
Well, I think it depends on Americans themselves. I mean, I think Nina proved my point perfectly. She took her experience in a totalitarian country like Iran and immediately applied it to every single Muslim country in the world falsely, and then did something even more disturbing, brought it to the United States in the same kind of rhetoric that we heard from Newt Gingrich during all this mosque controversy, right? We'll allow them to build a mosque in Ground Zero when they allow us to build a synagogue in Saudi Arabia. What in the world do we have to do with Saudi Arabia? How are we suddenly applying our rights and privileges, our very identity, to what is going on in, you know, these archaic parts of the world? This is not about them. This is about us. I think Ambassador Ahmed is absolutely right. We in the United States do not judge how we identify ourselves by how, you know, authoritarian or totalitarian countries around the world judge themselves. So I think really, you know, how this controversy comes to an end, how we deal with it, it involves some self-reflection. It involves looking at ourselves and recognizing what is it that we want to be, not how are we going to identify ourselves according to others, but how are we going to identify ourselves according to the values and the traditions that we hold dear. I think if we stay true to those values and traditions, then this will all blow over. Probably, Tom, and I don't mean to be cynical here, probably by the time the midterm elections are over.
Self-reflection in order, maybe all around here. Reza Aslan, author of Beyond Fundamentalism, joining us from Los Angeles today. Thank you so much for being here, Reza.
My pleasure.
And Akbar Ahmed, joining us from Washington. His team just put out Journey into America, The Challenge of Islam. Ambassador Ahmed, thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.